It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up with early voting well underway, less than a week now until the last day of the election, we'll get a final midterm preview from longtime politics watcher Craig Gilbert. First, new seasons bring about change for everyone, but for some people, the change of seasons can lead to a form of depression known as seasonal affective disorder, or SAD. The disorder is most common in fall and winter, which is why it's sometimes called winter depression. About 5% of Americans deal with seasonal affective disorder. Many more have milder seasonal symptoms. No surprise, it's more common in northern parts of the country where the days get shorter. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Am I talking about you? Have you experienced seasonal affective disorder before? Do you feel like your mood tends to change during a new season, during the colder months with more darkness here in Wisconsin? What time of year do you feel happiest or feel some of these symptoms? Have you found ways to deal with it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dr. Shyla Mergain is a distinguished psychologist at UW Health. Dr. Mergain, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Can you talk about some of the particulars of seasonal affective disorder? How do we diagnose that?
This is such a timely conversation with daylight savings time this weekend and the colder weather quickly approaching. And seasonal affective disorder is a recurrent form of depression that occurs seasonally, usually in the winter months, although occasionally it can happen in the summer, although that's quite rare. Symptoms of SAD, seasonal affective disorder, or SAD, include feeling down most of the day, nearly every day, loss of interest or pleasure in things that a person typically enjoys, significant fatigue, concentration problems, weight and sleep disturbance, and often a sense of hopelessness or helplessness. And what we're looking for when we're diagnosing seasonal affective disorder or SAD is that seasonal pattern and also the frequency and intensity of symptoms. So we're not looking for just one day where you feel kind of down, but more of a persistent pattern that it's occurring most of the day, nearly every day for at least 2 weeks, and also looking at the intensity and impact that we're looking at the symptoms causing significant distress or impacting various areas of functioning.
A lot of those symptoms you mentioned, I do associate with depression in general. How much overlap is there between seasonal affective disorder and depression as it's usually thought of?
Yeah, significant seasonal affective disorder is just a specifier of a major depressive episode or major depressive disorder. So the episode is occurring during that that season, typically the winter months. So it's often that is why there is that commonality.
Are there things in common for people who might feel a little bit of, you know, winter blah, but it's not full on seasonal affective disorder, and people who are feeling more seriously? Are there things that either of those groups of people can do that might help them a little bit?
Absolutely. While not everyone might experience seasonal affective disorder, many people are vulnerable to a milder form, what is often referred to as the winter blues. Just living here in Wisconsin, we know we're going to be going into that season where it's cold and dark, it's snowy and slippery, and certainly some of the stressors that are lingering with the pandemic can also make people vulnerable to just lower moods. So we really want to safeguard our mental health. And there are protective factors that can really improve our mood so that we, one, don't fall into a clinical depression, but two, that we're also not struggling with some of that blah mood, that lethargy, that lack of motivation. Also, many people during the holidays are vulnerable to negative health habits. So I think it's time to really work on that winter survival kit so we can stay healthy and happy this time of year.
Talking to Dr. Shyla Mergain from UW Health, psychologist there, looking at seasonal affective disorder. You can join in with your questions, maybe your experiences with SAD, seasonal affective disorder, maybe something you found that helps you or someone you know. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. All right, Dr. Mergain, let's get into some of those protective things that you just mentioned. And I know one thing that could happen in winter is if we're not getting outside as much, one thing we may not also be doing is hanging out with other people as much. How important is that social and community connection?
Thank you for mentioning those. When I think about a winter survival toolkit, I think about six different tools that really can be instrumental in safeguarding your overall well-being. And you're speaking to one of just staying connected. Winter can bring decreased socialization or social isolation. And we know that staying socially connected is one of those protective factors against developing depression. So, we really want to make staying socially connected a priority to maintain our well-being in a positive mood. So as we go into these colder, darker months, just thinking about a plan for staying in communication with those people who are helpful, who are important, who you love and care about. Could be a gathering in person, but we certainly have a lot of technology of even just doing a virtual call with somebody, or even just reaching out via text, or even just, as you mentioned, doing some exercise together. So doing an activity together can really be important so we don't get so isolated and feel so alone. And there's nothing like when we're in a bad mood, there's nothing like being around somebody who cares about you, who's a positive influence, to really boost that overall sense, giving you energy, giving you that motivation, giving you that perspective. So also reaching out to people if you are struggling to talk about it, to get that kind of support, can really be a safety net during these darker months ahead.
I want to key in on one word you use, and that's to have a plan to stay connected. Because I know if somebody's feeling depressed in the moment, it may be hard to spontaneously reach out and try to set something up with somebody. But if we get ahead of things, schedule things in advance, a weekly meetup or whatever it might be, that maybe we're going to stick to that.
Absolutely, right. Whether it's a regular thing that we're doing, and even just encouraging people to check in on you. Hey, can you check in on me in a couple weeks? Can be good. And sometimes when we're depressed or in that place of the winter blues, we get really inward focused. So another way of staying connected is just reaching out to somebody who might be struggling. It could be, even anonymously, like doing some random act of kindness of paying for somebody and line their coffee, the car behind you. And there is a research that random act of kindness can boost our mood as well. So, there's nothing like being of service, expressing that sense of purpose and those core values through doing something kind for somebody else. And that just gets us out of our inner self into the larger community and reminds us that we're not alone and that we still can make a difference. We have that purpose. And we can be of help.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi. I have seasonal affective disorder, and I've used the light box. But one thing I think that's really helped me is I take extra vitamin D in the winter, the sunshine vitamin.
Mm-hmm.
It really seems to help me.
Excellent. Kay, thank you so much for calling in and sharing both of those. Okay, a couple things there, Shyla. First of all, the vitamin D, is that, whether it's a supplement or in our food, is that something that's going to help?
I love it. Kay, thank you for sharing two really important tools in our winter survival toolkit. Vitamin D3, really encourage people to consume foods rich in vitamin D3 to counter the lack of sun exposure. So fish and mushrooms are great sources of vitamin D3. And for many people, vitamin D3 supplements are really important. So speak with your physician to find out if a supplement would be right for you, as well as the recommended dosage.
And exposing ourselves to more light, Kay mentioned, that might be getting out in the limited sunlight, or she mentioned light boxes.
Yeah, because the shortened daylight hours during fall and winter can disrupt the natural circadian rhythms. Exposure to light can be beneficial. And in two ways, as you're mentioning, there is a special light therapy box that has a full spectrum light bulb. And the recommendation is to sit in front of it for 30 minutes a day to counteract the effects of seasonal affective disorder. You always want to speak with your physician before using that kind of light therapy box. But also, as you mentioned, mentioned, just getting outside on those sunny days, increasing that time when weather allows outside, and also letting some natural light in. One of the best things to do in the morning is to open up the curtains, eat your breakfast in front of the window, read the newspaper in front of the window, listen to Wisconsin Public Radio in front of a window. So you're letting that natural light in, and that just helps balance those natural circadian rhythms of that sleep wake cycle, just to keep the system in balance.
Okay, thanks for calling. We're talking to Dr. Shyla Mergain, distinguished psychologist at UW Health, looking at seasonal affective disorder. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced this before? Are you worried about it coming into this winter season? Have you found solutions yourself? Do you have questions for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Dr. Shyla Mergain, distinguished psychologist at UW Health, with us today to talk about seasonal affective disorder and how to treat it. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 to share your own experience, maybe a solution you found, or a question for our guest. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Josie joins us now in Monona. Josie, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Josie?
We've been doing this since my oldest was a baby, so almost 9 years now. The conservatory at the Ulbrich Botanical Gardens right over here in Madison are fantastic, especially on those really cold, like it's too cold to go outside, but sunny days. Like you feel like you're, you know, in a summer somewhere tropical, and it really brings up your mood. We've done that with friends, and like I said, he's 9 now. We've done that since he was a baby, so it really helps a ton.
Fantastic, Josie. Thanks for sharing that. Shyla, what do you think?
I just love that. I was just there last week, Josie, with my little daughter, and saying, I have to come here in the middle of winter. I think that's such a great idea. And it speaks to the larger tool when we think about that winter survival toolkit of just self-care. There can be like a little outing that you look forward to and get excited about. That's a tradition, like going to Ulbrich Garden and in that inner conservancy. But, you know, it could be anything. We have the holidays coming up, and there may be some traditions that you can get excited about. Or maybe there's just a new skill, or even a staycation, taking a day off from work, or if you're not working, just a Saturday, make it like a little adventure, just discovering something new in your community. And we find that we have those enjoyable activities or something that we're planning and preparing to look forward to that actually can boost mood, and we're really cultivating our joy. Oftentimes this time of year can be quite stressful with the overall environment in our country and the holidays, and also working on some stress management skills, that we don't want to get so consumed by the stress that we lose track of what's most important. And so when we think about self-care, eating nutritious foods, watching alcohol intake, making sure you're sleeping, having those good healthy routines, even practicing some mindfulness, using your senses of just what delights your senses in this moment to really be here now, all of that, I think, are some of those kind of protective factors to really stabilize our mood.
And thanks for that call. Not everybody has a nice botanical garden with a conservatory nearby. How about the value of finding ways, even when the weather isn't great, to get outside?
Yeah, thank you. You know, we in Wisconsin, we are so blessed with our state parks, county parks, little areas for nature, and just to get outside on those warmer days. Or I think there's nothing like good winter gear to help you stay active during even the colder, snowier, icier days. And also thinking about a winter sport. Usually during the winter, we start to get lethargic and want to kind of hibernate like the bears do in the cave of our home. And we find that is not helpful long-term. Our winters last too long. And so, you know, if you can get out to a winter sport like hiking, skiing, or snowshoeing, or maybe joining a local gym, or even just going to some of our stores. And I've had people do that, going to one of the larger stores or the mall, and even get permission from the store owner to do some walking. keep going back up and down those aisles. Motion is really important to keep things fluid in our system. And, you know, so much research shows that exercise, aerobic exercise, like, for example, walking at a brisk pace for at least 3 times a week can be as beneficial as medication for mild to moderate forms of depression. So just to plan ahead of time, this time, how can I stay active? And some people are out of shape, Rob, and they feel kind of intimidated by going to a big gym. So I always say start small. Even 5 minutes can make a difference. 5 minutes of aerobic exercise, and even thinking about doing some resistance training as well, can really boost your mood and give you a pep in your step.
So a lot of great tools in the toolkit, Dr. Morgane. What is the line, though, where somebody should say, you know what, this is a little beyond these things helping me? When should people be thinking about getting some help for dealing with seasonal affective disorder?
Absolutely. I think that's such a great question and one to consider. And it's for yourself, but also if you see a loved one who's really struggling, maybe recommending that for them. So if those symptoms of seasonal affective disorder are persisting, they're not subsiding, if they're causing distress or impairment, for example, if you're having trouble getting out of bed, if you find that it's causing it's really hurting your relationships, or maybe you're suffering at work, don't hesitate to seek professional help. I think a real takeaway is early intervention helps people recover faster. For many people, medication management can be really useful, taking medication, antidepressant medication, especially during the winter months. And then therapy. You know, we live in a time where there's a lot of virtual treatments, so talk therapy can be quite useful as well, learning additional strategies like working with negative thinking and trying to create more balanced thinking, more helpful thinking, more coping thinking. That is something, for example, therapy can address. Sometimes dealing with those significant stressors that are tugging at your mood. So talking to your physician, your primary care physician, to find the most appropriate treatment for you, and don't hesitate to reach out for help. And also encourage loved ones to reach out for help as well. Don't be afraid to express, hey, I'm noticing you're struggling. You know, I recommend that you get some medical treatment for this. Can really do wonders. And certainly if a person is suicidal, that, you know, immediately we want help. There's a suicide hotline we can call, talking to your physician, going to the emergency room, or calling 911. We want to really address that immediately.
Dr. Morgane, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
That's Dr. Shyla Morgane, distinguished psychologist at UW Health. She joined us today to talk about seasonal affective disorder and what you need to know before we head into the colder months with shorter days. Inflation is an ongoing concern around most of the world and here in the U.S., as we've talked about on the show lately. In closely divided Wisconsin, it's top of mind for many voters who are getting ready to cast their ballots next week. Bridget Bowden reports.
Carol Henning and her husband recently retired and moved back to Wisconsin to be close to their daughter in Waukesha.
And so we are now those people who are living on a fixed income.
While she says they aren't in any financial danger right now, they have made adjustments at the grocery store, where costs are up 13% from last year.
And we are big grillers, so the meat market is one of our favorite places to be. Having watched some of those prices of things as simple as chicken breast just skyrocket, those were kind of go-to, safe, easy, inexpensive things.
Henning considers herself a Republican, but sometimes votes for Democrats. She hasn't decided who she'll vote for governor or U.S. senator yet, but she says the economy is her number one issue. And she's not alone. Milwaukee resident Amon Sayavong, an independent voter who often votes for Democrats, says he thinks the economy is the most important issue because it affects everyone.
Even though people will say, you know, people will talk about abortion or crime, I think you are not affected by that on a daily basis, but when you have to go and pay, you know, 10-20% more for your gas, that's something that affects you directly.
Inflation is an increase in prices that happens when demand exceeds supply. It's happening at high levels in the U.S. and around the world, thanks mostly to disruptions caused by the COVID-19 pandemic and the war in Ukraine, according to economists. In the latest Marquette University Law School poll released Wednesday, 68% of respondents said they were very concerned about inflation, the most of any issue. And so the candidates for statewide office are talking about it, like in the race for U.S. Senate between Republican Senator Ron Johnson.
Inflation is the Democrats' tax on the middle class.
And Democratic challenger Mandela Barnes.
Most senators couldn't tell you the cost of a gallon of milk.
And in the race for governor between Democratic Governor Tony Evers.
Folks, that's a problem. That's why I have a plan to cap prescription drug prices.
And Republican Tim Michaels.
Tim Michaels, I've got a blueprint to grow jobs and stop the outrageous spending that got us into this mess.
But according to University of Michigan labor economist Don Grimes, there are only so many ways to address inflation. One is to reduce demand. In other words, make people want to buy less. You can do that, Grimes says, by raising taxes. But in an election year, politicians don't want to talk about that.
And I wouldn't hold my breath after the election either.
The other way, which has already happened a few times this year, is through an interest rate hike from the nation's powerful central bank, the Federal Reserve. Grimes says that should slow inflation, but will likely cause other economic consequences.
I mean, I have no doubt in my mind that the Federal Reserve will bring down inflation. The problem is that they sort of have a blunt tool to do that, where they increase interest rates, and it tends to cause a recession frequently.
Regardless of what actually happens with the economy in the coming months, Grimes expects it will influence voters. He says historically, when people perceive the economy as bad, they punish the party in power. And that's why he thinks this will be a Republican year.
You know, politicians get too much credit when things are growing well, and they get too much blame when things are going bad, but that's the job they took.
But Grimes says there's a disconnect between what voters feel about the economy and what politicians can actually change. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, veteran journalist Craig Gilbert says we're in unusual territory with closely matched races for Wisconsin governor and Senate in the same cycle. We'll get a home stretch midterm preview. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Titanic is just one of the many famous shipwrecks around the world. We'll talk to the author of a new book about the fascination we have with the Titanic and the culture of exploring sunken ships. Now, less than a week out from the final day of the midterm election, we're going to take a home stretch look at where things stand and what could shift the balance in closely contested Wisconsin races. You can join in at 800-642-1234. As a voter, have you already voted? Are you planning to vote on election day itself? What's the experience been like if you've already voted? What are you watching for? Is there a race you're focusing on in the state? What questions do you have for our guest about the races for governor and U.S. Senate? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Craig Gilbert is a Lubar Fellow at Marquette University Law School. He was previously the Washington Bureau Chief and National Reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and has covered every presidential campaign since 1988. Craig, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be with you.
Well, something we've talked about here recently on Central Time, advertising in this race. I think the race for governor just hit record levels of spending. Does all that money, do you think, really make a difference?
Well, it can make a difference under certain circumstances. I mean, the classic situation is when one side heavily outspends another. It can make a difference. It can also make a difference when two sides are trying to define a challenger who's not well known or a lot less well known than the incumbent. It's easier to kind of, you know, affect public perceptions of a candidate who's less well known than one who's already kind of firmly established in the public eye. So those are kind of two cases, but often it's the returns are really marginal. I mean, there's nothing more inefficient probably than campaign spending or campaign ad spending. Everybody does it because they get something out of it. And they're also worried if they don't do it, then the other side is going to have the airwaves to themselves. But it's not a lot of bang for the buck. So, you know, generally it's not the most impactful thing in a campaign.
Well, those dollars might only sway a few voters, but only a few voters might make a difference. We're seeing the latest polling, including the Marquette Law School poll out yesterday, basically either tied or well within margin of error in both of our big statewide races for governor and U.S. Senator. What are your takeaways of the latest polling there?
So it's really striking. You know, there's been a lot of discussion about the polling and whether the polls are accurate or not. We do have a recent history of the polls undercounting or understating Republican support in the last two presidential races, not so much in the last midterm. So that question is out there. But if you view both of these races as very, very close races, it's kind of an unprecedented situation in Wisconsin. We've had close presidential races. In fact, we've had four presidential races out of the last six have been decided by less than a point. But there's very little history of ultra-thin races for governor and ultra-thin races for Senate. And to have two of them on the same ballot is something we really haven't seen before, certainly haven't seen it in decades. So that, I think, is what stands out to me about this circumstance. And we can talk about the forces, you know, we can talk about why that is. But we're certainly in a world, living in a world where in an evenly divided state like Wisconsin, there's not very much play in the electorate. Both sides are kind of, you know, have their 47% that they can count on, and they're battling over the rest. And so, you know, we don't see the, you know, generally don't see the 10 and 15 and 20 point margins you used to see in politics. And we see that we've seen from the start in these races that the movements, there are movements, but they're very small.
Comparing to like a 2018 where you had Governor Evers pulling it out by, or wasn't governor yet, but he won the race by about 1%. And then you had his Democratic colleague, Senator Tammy Baldwin, winning re-election, walking away, like a huge spread between those elections in Wisconsin terms. What happened there? Why don't you see it happening this time around with that spread?
Yeah, that was really kind of a special case in a couple of respects. I mean, for one, the governor's race was the closest governor's race in many decades. And on the other hand, you had, you know, an 11-point difference or 10-point difference between Tony Evers' 1-point victory for governor, 1-point Democratic victory, and Tammy Baldwin's 11-point Democratic victory for the U.S. Senate. And I think that was a combination of Tammy Baldwin being an effective candidate, certainly someone who spent a lot of time traveling around the state. I think she was very effective in kind of running on Wisconsin issues, running on local issues, running on things like dairy and Buy American. And she also had an opponent, Leah Vukmir, who had not run for statewide office before, who didn't have the same level of funding and organization and experience. So in kind of modern terms, it was kind of a one-sided campaign, and it produced a really this odd circumstance of a double-digit victory in kind of a 50-50 state. And I think what we're seeing in this cycle is, you know, tons of money and effort being poured in on both sides in both races. You know, obviously both sides are running real campaigns. And so, you know, we're left with, you know, the campaigns are kind of reverting or exposing what are these very even political divisions in the state. And this is kind of our state. It's a 51-49 state or a 50-50 state. And you don't have big advantages being brought to bear by either side that would open up these races beyond that.
Talking to Craig Gilbert, a longtime watcher of Wisconsin politics. It is a check-in before the midterms, which wrap up next week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Whatever you watch, wherever you go, do you see lots of ads? Are you getting texts Are ads showing up in your mail? You tired of them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Craig, in a recent piece, you wrote about some questions that these elections might answer. One is turnout. Now, the stereotype is presidential years, you get big turnout, midterms, not so much. What's been happening lately in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so back in 2014, the turnout was 55%. Voting age adults. And that was the highest turnout in decades. In 2018, it shot up to almost 60%, which was the highest turnout going all the way back to the Second World War. And maybe earlier for all I know, but our records only go back. My records only go back to the late 40s. So it was only about 6 or 7 points smaller than the presidential turnout of 2016. So, you know, whereas in the past you'd have like a 20 point difference between presidential turnout and midterm turnout. Now you're talking about a 5 or a 10 or 8 point difference. Midterm turnout's looking more like presidential turnouts. And so the question, you know, we're left with this cycle is, are we going to get, I mean, it's a high bar to match 2018. That was a crazy turnout. It was a crazy turnout year nationally. And Wisconsin had the second highest turnout in the country in 2018 because it's a high turnout state and there was a lot at stake. And there's a huge amount at stake in this cycle. Wisconsin's one of a dwindling number of true battlegrounds. So it's getting a lot of national effort and attention. And you've got these two big, close, consequential races on the ballot. So the ingredients seem to be there for a really big turnout. We don't know what that means exactly for the outcome of these races, because higher turnout could mean, you know, higher Democratic turnout and normal Republican turnout. It could mean the opposite. It could mean that both sides are kind of maximizing on turnout, and what's going to decide these races is not so much which side is turning out more voters, but how a kind of shrinking slice of independent voters are voting.
You are also watching the gender gap in votes. What are you looking for?
Yeah, what I think some people are missing about the gender gap is that, you know, particularly in the wake of the Dobbs decision overturning, the Supreme Court overturning a right to an abortion, overturning the Roe v. Wade decision, there's been a lot of focus on how that's affecting female voters. But what we've seen in Wisconsin in recent years really is as the state has shifted from being, you know, a modest Democratic advantage in party identity to being a very marginal Republican advantage, that shift has occurred because of a shift among men toward the Republican Party. So, you know, the gender gap can be a problem for either party. It can be a problem for the Republican Party when they lose ground with women, and it can be a problem for the Democratic Party when they lose ground with men. Right now, I mean, if anything, I think it's a bigger problem for the Democratic Party, or has become as big or a bigger problem for the Democratic Party, because they've lost ground with male voters, particularly kind of white, non-college male voters. And so, you know, what that bears watching in this cycle is again, in these races, whether the Democratic deficit among men is bigger or smaller than the Republican deficit among women.
We're talking to Craig Gilbert, former Washington bureau chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, now a fellow at Marquette University's Law School, with us taking a look at the home stretch in the midterm elections here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest? What are you watching for? What do you think is going to swing the election one way or another? Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Craig Gilbert, longtime national reporter, former Washington bureau chief at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, now a Lubar Fellow at Marquette University Law School, doing a final preview of the midterm election in Wisconsin. Early voting underway now. Final election day coming up Tuesday. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Steve is with us in Madison. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, hi. How's it going? Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what did you want to ask about, Steve?
Well, what I've been wondering about is, you know, I heard your caller or your guest touch on the abortion issue, but there's always been sort of this idea in politics that there's this third rail of politics that politicians never want to touch, and that's Social Security and Medicare. And I'm wondering, does your guest see that as playing a role in the election that we're coming up here? Or
Gotcha, Gary. You're breaking Steve, you're breaking up a little bit. But Craig, yeah, we had the head of the Republican Senatorial Reelection Committee saying, let's not get rid of Social Security or Medicare, but put it on the table, reevaluate it every few years, see if we need to make changes. Democrats have tried to make an issue of that. Is that something you think will be an issue?
Yeah, we've also had, you know, Republican Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin make comments about Social Security related to that. So it's an interesting question, and it's also been, you know, part of the kind of internal or maybe external debate about Democratic messaging. You know, Democrats are obviously facing some headwinds as the party in power in a midterm election with the economy performing the way it is. Joe Biden's numbers in kind of negative territory. And so you've got Democrats kind of arguing, I think, about whether they're how effective their own messaging has been. And one of those arguments I've heard is that, you know, people questioning whether the Democrats should be placing more emphasis or should have been placing more emphasis on those that particular set of issues in going after Republicans. And, you know, it's a good question. I mean, it is, as the caller pointed out, you know, it is something that comes, you know, discussing changes to Social Security and Medicare comes with huge political risks. And I think you've seen kind of Democrats trying to weigh, you know, what they think this campaign should be about, to what degree it should be about abortion, to what degree it should be about Donald Trump and the threat they believe Republicans pose to the election system, to what degree it should be kind of the Democratic response on the economy, and to what degree it should be this issue, which is, you know, basically, you know, debating which party is going to protect Social Security and Medicare. So, you know, I'm always hesitant to sort of second guess campaigns because I'm not kind of sitting where they're sitting. I think it'll be an interesting postmortem question, depending on the outcome of these races, as to whether, you know, it would have been smart politically to place more emphasis on this issue. You are hearing Democrats hit that issue harder in the closing weeks of the campaign.
Thanks for that call, Steve. Nate joins us now in Milwaukee. Nate, hello.
Hi, thank you for having me. I early voted. One of the things I think about, and I think other voters should do, is who do they think will be best for the state 6 months after the election when all the ads, good or bad, are long gone? And one of the things that ads were potentially effective is hitting Mandela Barnes when if the bail system that he supported was in place, the person who sadly killed a bunch of people in Waukesha would have actually been in jail because it would have been the risk to the community, and yet he was criticized for that. Looking at the governor's debate, which I already voted on, I think that Tony Evers both addressed the idea of helping local governments, which are facing problems now and will be in the future. And I'm worried that if Tim Michaels got elected, the rainy day fund would be gone and local governments would not be helped as much as they would be under Governor Evers, because the math that he did throw out during the debate doesn't add up with the budget.
Nate, thanks for the call. Craig, what do you think?
Well, you know, when you talk about the consequences of these elections, it's hard to even know where to start. I mean, it would be hard to envision a set of statewide elections that are, you know, in a midterm that are more consequential than these two. I mean, if you think about it on the Senate race side, the Senate is 50-50. So literally, you know, Wisconsin's Senate seat could be the difference between one party controlling the Senate and the other party controlling the Senate, which of course has massive implications when it comes to certainly the next 2 years of the Biden presidency and his, you know, ability to implement an agenda, get his nominations confirmed. It's and also setting up, you know, what it means for control of the Senate, you know, 2 years later and 2 years after that. And on the state side, you know, you have, you know, this certainty that Republicans will have a large majority in the legislature. So the difference between you know, the divided government that we have today and having full Republican control of the government in Wisconsin is pretty profound. Whether you're a Democrat or Republican, it's a pretty profound difference, and also has national implications because Wisconsin is one of a handful of states that may determine the presidency in 2 years. And the outcome of this race for governor will have a big effect on the conduct, the rules, the administration of the election in 2024, and whether that election is disputed or not after it takes place. So it's just, I mean, we talk about the importance of every election, but and this may be another reason why we do see a robust turnout in 2022, is that you couldn't really draw up a set of elections with more profound consequences, I think, for a state than these two.
Thanks for that call. That a quote from a Republican candidate, Tim Michaels, for governor got a lot of attention this week. In the midst of a campaign talk, he said, "Republicans will never lose another election in Wisconsin after I'm elected governor." A campaign spokesperson said later he was referring to the policies are going to be so good, Republicans won't lose. People worried about the future of elections are worried that, you know, that was a statement that he would make changes in the election system. How much is at stake in how we run elections in the state if Republicans then had that control of the legislature, very likely, and the governor's office?
Yeah, so, I mean, a lot could be at stake. And sometimes, you know, you can overstate the importance of some of these issues, some of the election disputes that we've had in the state. There's been running battles over the election rules in Wisconsin, you know, for several decades. And sometimes the battles are over pretty, mm-hmm. You know, the small print of election administration. Sometimes they're over exactly how long is the early voting window going to be, exactly what are the rules, you know, for absentee mail ballots. It can get pretty detailed, and these things are all important. They're not all existential, but the big questions are when you talk about election changes that might, you know, really hold down the vote by making it harder for people to vote, and more important than anything, when you talk about, you know, what happens in the event of a disputed election, and if you talk about scenarios where there's the possibility, as we saw, you know, in 2020, when there was an attempt to decertify or overturn the election, I mean, that's existential. And so, you know, we don't know exactly whether there would be a repeat of that in 2024. That's certainly obviously what has some Democrats very alarmed when, you know, given all the rhetoric on the Republican side about disputing the 2020 election and promises that Republicans are making to some people in their political base about how they're going to handle elections in the future, that has put, you know, that set of issues has raised the profile of those issues and, you know, understandably made it a concern to a lot of voters.
Time for one more quick call from Gary in Greendale. Gary, hi.
Do you mean Glendale, Rob?
I guess so. I had Greendale, yeah. But I bet you're right. Glendale it is, Gary. Hi.
Okay. Thanks, Rob. Craig, one of the polls this week indicated that down the line, the favorability rating of Democratic candidates was much higher than those of the Trump Republican candidates. And my nephew disclosed this weekend, longtime Republican, he can't vote for Michaels. How much of an effect do you think will have people in Georgia who are longtime Republicans voting for Reverend Warnock rather than for Herschel Walker?
Oh, Gary, thanks. About half a minute for your thoughts. Republicans.
Yeah, so big question. We've seen, you know, obviously the fundamentals in this election in many ways are favorable to Republicans, but we've also seen issues surrounding some of the individual Republican candidates like Herschel Walker in Georgia and like Dr. Oz in Pennsylvania. So it sort of sets up this question as to whether their liabilities as candidates are enough to prevent them from winning otherwise winnable races for Republicans in what should be a good Republican year. So that's a big question nationally.
Gary, thanks for the call. And Craig, thanks for being with us.
Absolutely.
That's Craig Gilbert, longtime reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, now a Lubar Fellow at Marquette University Law School, with us for a look at the big questions about the elections here in Wisconsin. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, take an art tour with museums around the state sharing their collections, and you can tell us about your favorite place to go check out some art. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8, and that's here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And you can get started on that conversation right now. Email ideas@wpr.org if you want to send a shout-out to your favorite art museum in Wisconsin or beyond. Even if you work there, that's okay to put in a plug. Email Kate's team, ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. We all grow up knowing that a cow says moo and a cat goes meow. And a few years back, there was an explosion of public interest in the question, what does the fox say? But here's a question, what sound does a turtle make? And hang on, does a turtle make a sound? The answer is yes, and now there are recordings to prove it. As reported by NPR, many turtle species were thought to be voiceless, or if they did make sounds, nobody knew about them. A couple of biologists teamed up, developed a hydrophone, an underwater microphone that would let them record sounds underwater. They tested turtles, tortoises, and some other species. They found that yes, indeed, a lot of them do make sounds. You just got to listen. Here's a sample of a southern New Guinea giant softshell turtle. What do we call that sound? A turtle goes woo-woo? I don't know. And are these guys using sounds to communicate with each other? That's a whole other question. I got to get one of those hydrophones so I can do the show while I'm swimming. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.